Is a spring offensive brewing in Luhansk?
Luhansk Governor Serhiy Hayday says there is an active transfer of Russian troops to the region, and they're definitely preparing for something on the Eastern Front in February.
Plus, more senior Ukrainian officials lose their jobs.
For the moment, we know that today Ukrainian Cabinet of Ministers fired the acting head of the Ukrainian Customs Service and the active head of the Ukrainian Tax Service.
And later in the program, the U.S. says that Russia isn't doing its part in the New START nuclear treaty. We'll take a look. Today is Wednesday, February 1st. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. More shelling and more casualties in Bakhmut could portend a Russian offensive developing in Luhansk. The Associated Press's Charles de la Desma brings us the latest.
Ukraine's presidential office says around 5 civilians have been killed and at least 10 wounded in the last 24-hour period. Russian forces have shelled Bakhmut in the eastern Donetsk region, killing 2 residents and wounding a further 6. Regional Governor Pavlo Kirilenko has posted images of the aftermath of the shelling, showing huge black holes in residential buildings in the embattled city. Kirilenko says the Russians are actively deploying new military personnel in the region. Officials say Russia's mustering its military might in the Luhansk region of Ukraine in what Kyiv suspects is preparation for an offensive in the eastern area in the coming weeks. Military analysts anticipate a new push soon by Moscow's forces, with the Institute for the Study of War saying in an assessment late Tuesday that an imminent Russian offensive in the coming months is the most likely course of action. Luhansk Governor Serhiy Hayday says there is an active transfer of Russian troops to the region, and they're definitely preparing for something on the Eastern Front in February. In the country's eastern Luhansk region, officials report Russian forces have begun expelling local residents from their homes near the front line, so they would not transmit information about the Russian forces' deployments. A new offensive might also coincide with the invasion anniversary on February 24. I'm Charles de la Desma.
There's a new treatment for children suffering the psychological effects of war. We'll learn about that in a few minutes. Now, diplomacy. The U.S. is accusing Russia of not living up to its obligations under the New START nuclear treaty. For more context, I'm joined by VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent, Cindy Sain.
This New START treaty came into force in 2011, and it was extended in 2021 for 5 more years. And what it does is it caps the number of strategic nuclear warheads that both the U.S. and Russia can deploy, and it caps it at 1,550 strategic nuclear weapons each. And it also caps the deployment of land and submarine-based missiles and bombers to deliver those nuclear weapons. So this is a very significant treaty. It is the last remaining one. All the others have fallen by the wayside between U.S. and Russia. And as people may know, the U.S. and Russia account for about 90% of the world's nuclear warheads. And especially now where we have a very tense situation between the two countries because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, this is arguably even more critical.
So what is it that the United States is accusing Russia of?
Right. The U.S. says that Russia is violating the treaty by refusing to allow inspectors on its territory. And it has also halted regular compliance meetings, which are also mandatory. And Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, said that arms control cannot be isolated from other geopolitical realities, probably referring to the war in Ukraine. And he said that Russia sees it as inappropriate to invite the U.S. to its strategic facilities at this point in time.
Well, that brings up my next question, is that looking at a weapons treaty, in context of the Ukraine war, especially when Putin alluded to the possible use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine. This is a particularly scary moment.
Yes, that's right, Steve. And you mentioned a very important point, is that there are very real fears that that Russia could possibly use a tactical weapon in Ukraine, especially if things are not going well and it cannot seem to prevail otherwise. And what the U.S. is saying is that it doesn't want to give up on this agreement. It says that Russia has a clear path for returning to compliance by allowing inspections. And it says one other thing that Russia has brought up, that its officials couldn't travel to the U.S. And the U.S. made clear on Tuesday that there will be no restrictions for Russian inspectors to travel to the U.S.
Well, just to be clear, this is a treaty between the United States and Russia. Ukraine's not a party to this treaty, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Ukraine is not a party to this treaty, and the U.S. is basically trying to keep these issues separate and trying to keep up some, you know, sort of basic relationships. And, you know, the U.S. still has its ambassador in Moscow, and Russia, you know, said Wednesday that it also wants to hold on to the last remaining treaty. So I think at some level there is willingness on both sides, because both sides perhaps think it's in their own best interest to continue this treaty.
One final question for you, Cindy. You mentioned that this treaty will be expiring relatively soon. Given the state of relations between the United States and Russia, is there any hope for this treaty being extended or replaced?
Well, that's a good question, Steve. And, you know, I think, like you said, basically we still have until 2026. And the reason I believe that the State Department, issued this now, it was actually a report to Congress, and they were pushed by especially Republicans in the House and Senate, who asked, you know, is Russia in compliance? And also some Democrats, like the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Menendez, has said, look, if Russia is not complying, they can't just sort of willy-nilly pick and choose what they want to comply with. And this will have consequences when the Senate is considering any future arms control treaties with Russia.
Cindy Sain is VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent. Cindy, thanks for your time today. Thanks for your analysis.
My pleasure.
Updates from the front lines and news of another round of job losses for some senior Ukrainian officials. For the latest, we check in with Anna Chernikova, our reporter in Kyiv.
Today, Ukraine woke up with the news of a new raid operation in different parts of Ukraine. And for the moment, we know that today, Ukrainian Cabinet of Ministers fired the acting head of the Ukrainian Customs Service and the active head of the Ukrainian Tax Service. This is probably, you know, the biggest news. Also what we can see in terms of the raids, that these raids are happening within this structure. So Customs Service, Tax Service representatives from different areas. Also, there are raids of the construction company, which is the owner of this company is Ukrainian member of the parliament who is close to Viktor Medvedchuk. Viktor Medvedchuk, I would remind, is the guy who was accused of being Russian agent, and he has very close personal connections to President Putin, and he was exchanged for 200 Ukrainian soldiers months ago. So this guy, this member of parliament, he is also the owner of a huge construction company, and he is now also under the Security Service of Ukraine investigation. And this investigation is about the legalization of money which might be connected to Viktor Medvedchuk. So basically, this is some like anti-corruption anti-corruption operations which are ongoing.
Now, would these anti-corruption investigations have anything to do with the EU summit going on in Kyiv later this week?
Definitely, Ukrainian anti-corruption reform and anti-corruption actions are crucial for Ukrainian-European integration. And this was not only announced by Ukrainian officials, but also by the European officials, European heads and European allies of Ukraine. They every time in every speech regarding Ukrainian or every report about Ukrainian continuous integration to the European Union under the partnership agreement, they highlight very much the anti-corruption reform. And definitely this goes in line with that.
What's the appetite like for it among Ukrainian citizens? Do they see this as a positive change?
Definitely. Ukraine is famous, unfortunately, for such, you know, corruption schemes and corruption scandals for years, and for the past, and every government was doing certain movements in order to somehow show that anti-corruption sphere is working. But to be honest, it was not always the case, and it was not always the priority. So it's really positive for Ukrainian citizens that this is now, at least it seems at this point of time, that this is a priority. And again, Ukrainian citizens, of course, connect this directly with European integration agreement.
Now, Anna, all of this is happening in the context of the Russian invasion. Let's get an update on how that's going. I understand fighting in the east is still very intense, and Ukrainian soldiers are preparing for a Russian springtime offensive.
Yes, fightings continue and fightings are intensifying. And today, Ukrainian intelligence service once again highlighted that Ukraine is entering this next one of the most active phase of this war, and they expect this most active phase in February and in March. And of course, considering that in February Ukraine would mark 1 year since full-scale invasion, Ukrainians in general are getting ready for a lot of provocations and a lot of escalations from Russia, not particularly only at the front line, but definitely at the front line, but also Ukrainian citizens are expecting shellings across the country. And for the moment, what we can see that definitely Russian forces are concentrating their main forces in the Donetsk region and in the Luhansk region. And Luhansk region is almost completely under Russian control. Donetsk region is mostly also under Russian control, but still Russian forces have this goal that was announced by President Putin, that they should take control of Donetsk region in full. So this is definitely what they are trying to do. And of course, it's important to understand that Donetsk region for this point of time is the main region for supply to the occupied territories in Zaporizhia and in Kherson region, because after the damage to Crimea breach, this is the only way. And in general, for Russian forces, it's important to keep Donetsk region also for the protection of potential Ukrainian counteroffensive in the direction of Zaporizhia and maybe even in the direction of Crimea. But again, this we cannot really confirm. But definitely, the area in the Zaporizhia region is pretty much connected to this defense line that Russian forces are trying to build in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions.
And that'll do it for today. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. As we've learned with all the drama around tanks, providing weapons for Ukraine, and where they come from, is complicated. Until last year, many countries in Western Europe had long-standing policies against sending weapons into war zones. Russia's invasion of Ukraine quickly changed all that. VOA's Seoul bureau chief Bill Gallo reports that those countries, most notably Germany, Sweden, and Norway, changed course, eventually donating several rounds of arms to help Ukraine fight a battle they see as decisive for Europe's future. But after nearly a year of fighting, and with Europe now struggling to produce enough ammunition for Ukraine and for itself, the search is on for other sources of weapons. Some are looking to Northeast Asia for help. More from VOA's Steve Miller.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg urged South Korea on Monday to increase military support to Ukraine, citing other countries that have changed their policy of not providing weapons to countries in conflict following Russia's invasion.
At the end of the day, a decision for you to make. But I will say that several NATO allies who had as a policy never to export weapons to countries in conflict have changed that policy now.
Stoltenberg was speaking in Seoul, the first stop on a trip that also included Japan, and is aimed at strengthening ties with Western allies in Asia in the face of the war in Ukraine and rising competition in China. Speaking at the Chae Institute for Advanced Studies in Seoul, he thanked South Korea for its non-lethal aid to Ukraine, but urged it to do more, adding that there is an urgent need for ammunition.
If we don't want autocracy and tyranny to win, then they need weapons. That's the reality.
South Korea has signed major deals providing hundreds of tanks, aircraft, and other weapons to NATO member Poland since Russia invaded Ukraine. While in Japan, Stoltenberg visited the Iruma Air Base in Saitama Prefecture, meeting air self-defense force troops and viewing aircraft and equipment.
The war in Ukraine matters for all of us, and therefore we are also very grateful for the support that Japan is providing, using also the planes and the cargo capabilities that are based at this air base.
He went on to say that the war in Ukraine demonstrates that security is interconnected.
If President Putin wins in Ukraine, it will be a tragedy for the Ukrainians, but it will also send a very dangerous message to authoritarian leaders all over the world. Because then the message will be that when they use military force, they can achieve their goals.
Japan has condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine, imposed sanctions on Moscow, and is providing Ukraine non-lethal military supplies, humanitarian assistance, and financial support. Russia calls the invasion launched on February 24th of last year a special operation to ward off threats to its own security. Steve Miller, VOA News.
Some 2 million Ukrainian children have been displaced by the war. For those forced to leave and those still in Ukraine, the war can have severe psychological impacts. But a simple therapeutic tool is helping some kids cope. Anna Kostachenko produced the story, narrated for us today by Steve Baragonia.
Anya is 9, and since day one of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, she has been in Kyiv with her parents, who did not give their last name. Shelling and air raid sirens are part of her daily life.
We boarded windows after two rockets landed 600 meters from our apartment building.
Their mother says she can see how the war is affecting Anya and her two sisters.
She became somewhat withdrawn, sometimes aggressive and tense. I was constantly worried this may end up with Anya having a nervous breakdown.
But Anya is getting some help from Hibuki, a word that means hugs in Hebrew. Hibuki is a therapeutic toy invented in Israel in 2006. As a way to help children deal with stress during the 2006 Lebanon War. In April 2022, Ukrainian psychologists started giving Hibuki toys to some of the traumatized children in Ukraine. Anya's family was one of the first in Kyiv to receive it.
After 3 or 4 weeks, we saw the obvious results. Anya started to communicate with kids again, became friendly, a lot calmer.
Victoria Nazarevich was one of the first professional psychologists in Ukraine to use it during her work with kids.
So many children are traumatized. They lost their homes. They suffer from daily rocket attacks. We were trying to find something that would help them deal with trauma, and it appeared to be a toy that children can hug and interact with.
Art therapist Marina Cherkashina says Hibuki helps kids dispel stress, which is healthier than keeping it all inside. And its paws always offer a child a much-needed hug.
We call it Huggy Dog. We have kids here who have not left Kyiv since the start of the war. They were the first children to receive Hibuki.
So far, over 5,000 Ukrainians have been able to experience the therapeutic benefits of Hibuki. Thanks to the U.S. nonprofit charity United Help Ukraine. The group funds psychology training courses explaining how to work with Hibuki.
I'm trying to look like I'm okay, but inside, I panic.
8-year-old Pablo's mother, Mariana, said Hibuki helped her son a lot.
He completely changed. We got to see our child from new angles. He's more open now.
Ukrainian psychologists have also invented a little hedgehog toy that attaches to the child's hand. In addition, psychologists here are also using art therapy to help children deal with their trauma, while Hibuki sits nearby. For Anna Kostyuchenko in Kyiv, Ukraine, Steve Barragona, VOA News.
The Ukrainian city of Irpin in the Kyiv region was occupied by Russian forces in March. Officials say over 70% of its infrastructure was damaged. When the Russians retreated, several residents returned from abroad to help rebuild their city. Anna Kostyuchenko has the story of an artist.
In the 7 years she's been an artist, Ukrainian Sofia Dzubluk has created more than 120 murals, including one in the U.S. city of Charlotte, North Carolina. She ended up in Charlotte after fleeing Russian attacks on her native city of Irpin in the Kyiv region.
Our town was under occupation for a month. A rocket hit a fence near our house. All the windows were smashed.
She found refuge and friends in North Carolina, like local artist Sidney Duarte, who encouraged Dzubluk to paint a mural about Russia's war against Ukraine. Dzubluk says she had a good life in the U.S., but when she got the chance to head back to Irpin, she decided to go.
I could participate in the program that allowed you to stay and work legally in the U.S., but when I saw that the Irpin Reconstruction Summit project was starting, I realized that I wanted to participate in the reconstruction of my city.
She returned to Ukraine in May and has been volunteering in Irpin. She is helping rebuild a local school. Dzubluk and her fellow artists decided to do what they do best, paint murals. But it will take more than just murals to fix this town. 70% of Irpin's infrastructure was damaged or fully destroyed during the war. Over 16,000 residents lost their homes, and more than 60,000 found theirs significantly damaged.
We are developing a new concept for the city. It is very inspiring, especially since there is direct communication with local authorities. We can talk to the mayor and pitch our ideas on the reconstruction of the city.
A team of rebuilders have big plans for a new Irpin, and Dzubluk is happy to be a part of it. The hope is to rebuild and modernize all the destroyed buildings and add more color to this once thriving town. Anna Kostyuchenko for VOA News, Irpin, Ukraine.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America.
Washington, D.C.